Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.
Do-da.
Welcome, welcome to Time Out. This is your host, Sylvia Crawley Milbury, and today we have an interesting show lined up for you. We had another guest on, but after what's been going on lately, I decided to postpone that show because I felt like there was something else that needed to be addressed. And so we are going to talk about the Zimmerman trial today. And so on the call, I have a couple of people. We'll have some more people join us in just a few minutes. But we have on the call Dr. Philip Cunningham. He's a visiting assistant professor of media studies at Quinnipiac University. Phil, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And then I just want to say welcome to the show, Phil. I'm happy that you could make time to do this for us today.
Thank you for having me.
And then we have Ms. Angel Arnold, and she is a housewife, and she's going to give her perspective. And, Angel, I just want to thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And later we will have Dr. Rex Crawley join us, as well as some others, and we'll introduce them as they come in. I think everybody can agree that our entire nation was in shock a couple of days ago when the verdict came out. And no matter what side of the, no matter what side you were on, I think everybody was just kind of in shock of kind of what goes on in our country. I think a lot of light was shed on some things, some deep root issues that we need to address as a country. And so as I started to look on Facebook, I saw that a lot of people had an opinion about it. Even people who usually don't comment on Facebook, they just kind of look at other people's posts and like them. They even said, you know, I normally don't comment on Facebook, but I just got to say this. And so it just felt like people had emotions. They had things that they were feeling about the trial that they felt like they needed to say. And so we decided to have a discussion about it here on Time Out. And so we have a few sound bites that we'll listen to, and then we'll get opinions on those sound bites. And so, first of all, I want to start with you, Dr. Cunningham. Just talk about your views on the trial and how you felt when the verdict came out.
So in terms of, like, the verdict, I just, you know, it was one of those weird moments, and in particular where it's like I'll always remember what I was doing when it was announced, because at that very moment I was actually finishing up a birthday celebration for my father-in-law, who was, just turned 70 years old. And as we were leaving to take my nephew home, we overheard on the radio that the verdict had came out. And it really put me in a kind of weird space, right, because I had just been spending time with, you know, a gamut of black men of various ages, right, my 7-year-old father-in-law, me, who, you know, will be 39 next month, my younger nephews. And, you know, for a moment, we were all able to sort of forget that this thing was actually going on, right, that this fateful trial was going on. And then it was announced. And I was just stunned, and I've been in this perpetual state of being stunned ever since, so much so that, you know, as you know, people are commenting on Facebook, I couldn't even find the words to do so, which is a bit of irony, considering that I talk all the time.
Yes, that's surprising to me, Dr. Cunningham. Angel, can you talk about your thoughts on the trial and how you felt when the verdict came out as well?
Well, like Dr. Cunningham said, when the verdict came out, I was stunned, but I was stunned for, I think, a totally different reason than most of my friends on Facebook, because of my views, I've been unfriended by 4 people on Facebook because I don't agree that he was guilty. I watched, you know, the trial off and on periodically, and the last, I guess, 2 days, that's all we had on in the house, which is unusual for us because we're usually watching something else or doing something else. And I told my husband, I said, no, because once that jury deliberated, I said, I'm not doing anything else. We're watching this because this is going to be huge. This is something that's going to change or impact, you know, young people, old people, black, white, you name it. It's going to have a huge impact because it was such a televised and it was such a big trial. And when the verdict came, I sat there for a while and I looked at my husband and I said, wow, that just totally floored me. I did not see that coming, even, you know, the way I thought. I can't believe that they did that. And, you know, like Dr. Cunningham said, you know, he was in a room with, you know, young men of all ages. I had my son and my daughter, my husband in the room. And even then I was sitting there going, okay, what do I say to them? And they sort of think like I do, but it's still, you know, what do you say? Because it was such a big thing, and I'm still a little in shock at the verdict. I'm in shock in a sort of kind of way.
Let me ask you this. This is one thing that you said that I agree with. This is a huge moment for our country, I think. Almost like it's a turning point for our country. May I ask why you believe Zimmerman was innocent? And we respect your opinion. First of all, I want to say that we respect all opinions on this show. We will listen to every opinion. So I'm just interested and curious to know why you think Zimmerman was not guilty.
I believe he was innocent to, I guess, like a certain point. To me, when he, because he was doing his, I guess, a job. He was doing. He was doing a job. He was doing, you know, what he was supposed to do. Rent a cop, whatever. He was doing that. This was a neighborhood that for, I don't know how many months, weeks, whatever, a lot of the homes had been vandalized, and they said that in the trial. You know, suspicious people walking around. I, for one, and this is just, I can only speak for myself. If it's at night, if you saw my town that we live in, it's a mile wide. You could walk the entire town in like 10 minutes. But if it's at night, if I'm by myself and I see someone coming towards me in a hoodie and I can't tell who they are or whatever, I'm going to be, you know, weary of it. The only thing he did wrong was he did not stand his ground and just leave. They told him to leave. He didn't leave. That's the only thing he did wrong to me. And I know a lot of people don't agree with that, but, you know, I thought long and hard, and because someone even asked me, well, what if it was your son? And I really had to think. I said, okay, if it were my son, well, number one, he wouldn't. It's hard to say what I would do if it were Dakota. Dakota's been taught, you know, if Zimmerman had come to him and was harassing him physically, by all means necessary, you defend yourself. But if he's just, you know, giving him a hard time verbally, you keep on going. I don't care what is said or even if he follows you, you keep on going. You don't stop and confront him. Just keep walking.
Okay. I'd like to play a sound bite. Our producer is on the show. Vic, can you play the first sound bite with the verdict?
Coming right up as soon as I get to it. Verdict.
And also on the call, we have Dr. Rex Crawley. He is a dean of communications at Robert Morris University and also assistant dean of communications. And we're going to have him share his views right after this soundbite.
We're waiting for it to come up, Sylvia. I'm having problems with it coming up.
Okay, well, Rex. Dr. Crawley, are you there? Can you?
I am. Good evening, Sylvia Crawley Nation.
good evening. I would like to hear your views on the case and how you felt when the verdict came out.
Okay, sure. First of all, I just can't find in my heart or mind any way to justify Zimmerman's behavior, his attitude, his worldview. As a black masculinist, it's impossible for me to sympathize with anyone that has a disregard for black young male lives. Black men are dying too frequently, too often. And the shame of it is that America doesn't seem to care. So my surprise was not at the verdict, because when I watched the trial and I saw how the prosecution was handling the case, I think the jury actually did their job. If that jury had found him guilty, I think there would have been some issues. So the issue is not with the jury at all. The issue is not even with the decision. The issue is with the case. And so that's what I was afraid the entire time, because based on how the prosecution presented the evidence, it made it clear that the jury, in deliberating the evidence fact by fact, that they would in fact have to say there was just not compelling evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to say that, you know, that he was guilty. And so that's not the issue. I think that, and the other thing is that's interesting to me, and I'm trying to, play devil's advocate here, and what struck me was that the race cards weren't played, and everybody's been talking about that. And so there's been, commentators who are suggesting that even that was purposeful, because if they had found him not guilty and the race card had been played, then he could not be tried again from a civil rights perspective. So it's a good thing that the prosecution was either clever or they were idiots. So they realized they couldn't win this, and they recognized that there was an opportunity for a civil rights case. And if he was found guilty, if he found not guilty and race had been introduced, he would have been double jeopardy. They could not have tried him again. So the fact that they didn't introduce race now allows the Justice Department to do an investigation and hopefully bring charges against them. So there's some ray of optimism, and also there's a civil opportunity for the family to seek justice. So it was just a strange night. On one hand, I'm sitting there strategically saying, okay, this is bad, but it's good. This is good, but it's bad. And so it's just interesting to see how this plays out in the hearts and minds of people across the nation.
Well, I do agree with you. I think there's the issue is with our justice system, and according to it, I think just like the OJ trial, if there's not enough evidence to convict someone, then, that's the judicial system, And so it's unfortunate because there's a hurting community, there's a hurting family, the family of Trayvon. So it's just very unfortunate that this had happened. But I do understand what you're saying, Dr. Crawley. We have our soundbite ready. I'm going to ask our producer if he can go ahead and play it now.
This city has been quiet, but Martin family attorney Benjamin Crump told us he understands why people elsewhere have protested.
This verdict says certain children can have a target on their back just because of what they wear and how they look.
The only target, defense attorney Don West told ABC News, is George Zimmerman.
I don't know how he could not lawfully carry a gun at this point.
Zimmerman is entitled to the 9mm pistol he used to shoot Trayvon Martin, and his attorneys say if necessary, he'd use it again. Aaron Katursky, ABC News, Sanford, Florida.
Dr. Cunningham, let me ask you this. As a young African-American male, what kind of feelings does this send to you in terms of your safety, you know, because this could happen to anyone. Can you share your views on that?
Well, first of all, I mean, because you know what I look like visually, right, that I'm relatively small, relatively youthful looking, right, in my appearance. I've lived most of my life not genuinely feared, or I'll tell you, or so I had previously thought, right? I've sort of put myself into this cocoon where I thought because I generally am well received by most people, because I am not sort of threatening to most people, that I'm walking about with a certain sort of safety. That being said, this trial has sort of made me realize something in the fact that I look so young in some regards. To many people, that's actually quite frightening, right? I mean, if a youthful person is seen walking around in the neighborhood, to some, a youthful black male is seen in the neighborhood, it is frightening to some. And I've actually experienced this in the complex in which I live in, right? And when I go check the mail, I usually just go out and you know, just jog out to the mailbox because our mailbox is out towards the front of the complex. And I've seen people literally turn around when they were on their way to get their mail because they saw me walking towards it. Or there's been other times where now I'm sort of hyper aware of what my youthful appearance looks like, even though, you know, again, I'll be 39 next month. And so really that's what the trial has done for me. It's made me very hyper aware of the fact that just because I think I'm not threatening doesn't mean that somebody does not perceive me that way. And that's really put me in kind of weird space. And then I have to imagine, well, what happens when you actually do have the qualities that someone might think are threatening in your young African-American male, right? What if you are tall? What if you are muscular? What if you are, you know, dressing as youthful people do? I can only imagine now what those things, what those type of people go through. And so now, like I said, I'm just now hyper aware of that, and that's unfortunate. But on the one hand, it's unfortunate that I have to realize that, and it takes moments like this for me to realize it. But on the other hand, it's my wake-up call.
And speaking of wake-up calls, I think this is a wake-up call for America. I think this has been going on for years. It just happens to be your personal wake-up call, Dr. Cunningham, but I think it sheds light on what African-American people, and especially African-American men, go through in this country. We're going to go to another sound bite. We're going to have our producer play the next one.
From Miami to New York, his verdict sparking protests, including one that turned destructive in Oakland, California. In this church in Miami Gardens, Florida, that Martin used to attend, his cousin shared their disappointment in the outcome.
We don't want this to happen to anyone else again.
While Martin's parents mourn, absent from in this verdict, their attorney says, because of death threats, Zimmerman, always maintaining he killed Martin in self-defense, remains in hiding in fear for his safety.
So there are people protesting all across the country, especially in Florida and many other places. We're going to talk in a few minutes about what we can do, meaning we as America can do besides protesting to deal with the issues at hand. But I think first we need to identify the root issue. Angel, I would like for you to address, like, what do you think is the real root issue of what's going on right now, quickly?
Well, they put race in it, I don't think race should be in it at all.
Okay, so what do you think is the root issue?
A man killed another man. A man killed a boy and then got off scot-free. To me, that should be the root issue. He killed a boy and basically was told, well, or basically they told everyone else, yeah, he killed him, but it's okay. There's no race. There should not be a race issue here. He killed a boy point blank because of his overzealousness.
Dr. Crawley, what do you think the root issue is here?
I think the real issue is the fact that African American male lives are not valued in American society. So, and the other issue that no one's talking about is age. A teenage boy deals with fear very differently than a grown man. We've been trained and educated on how to manage lots of emotion. So if you're a teenage kid and you're walking down the street and you're African American and some dude is following you, naturally you're thinking, I got to get out of this situation and or defend myself. So if anything, the stand your own ground logic should apply to Trayvon. He had a right to defend himself against this man who was following him and then who ultimately had a gun. So even if a fight ensued, and even if Trayvon instigated the fight, he was defending himself because he was walking from the store trying to get home, and some man is following him. So is race the issue? Of course it is. If there was a young white boy walking down the street, Zimmerman would have said, excuse me, young man, it's past curfew. Shouldn't you be at home? You know, he wouldn't have stopped him the way that he did. And the only reason he did that is because he was a young African-American male. So is race involved in this? Yes. Is this a hate crime? Yes. Is this a civil right offense? Yes. I don't know how anyone can escape those realities.
Dr. Cunningham.
Yes.
What do you feel like is the root issue?
I think at the heart of this really is race, and I'm inclined to agree with Dr. Crawley. You can't escape it. Even if it's not spoken. And so as a result, I mean, and I think, you know, because it's not spoken, it's easy to sort of, believe that this is a case in which someone is simply just concerned about the safety of their neighborhood. But who is he concerned about the safety of his neighborhood from, right? He's afraid, literally, of young black men. Whether that fear is warranted is a conversation for, you know, maybe later on. But race is at the heart of it, and I think it's undeniable, even though it's not spoken.
Okay. What, in your opinion, can be done? And I think protesting says, hey, we're not going to stand for this. You know, we're not going to idly stand by. We're going to voice our opinion. We're going to show you that we're not accepting this. So I think protesting is one way to deal with it, but Dr. Crawley, can you tell me, in your opinion, what is the best way, in your opinion, to deal with this root issue, which you identified as race?
I mean, I think that it's a societal issue with no easy answer. I've, as a professor of communication, intercultural communication in particular, you know, that's, you know, what we've dedicated our lives to, is trying to figure out a way to help America become more interculturally competent. And, I mean, we've made huge gains. As an African-American male, as a PhD, I recognize the privilege that affords me. And unlike Dr. Cunningham, you know, I'm 6'4", 230 pounds, very black and very bald. So I recognize, you know, how intimidating folks can be for me. So even in my university, I came in on a Saturday to work out in my sweat clothes and my, you know, baseball cap, and the police officer stopped me and wouldn't let me in the building and cussed me out virtually, saying, you football players, no, you're not allowed in this part of the building, and what are you doing here, and just really going off on me until finally I said, dude, I'm a professor here. He did not believe me. He had to call another police officer who recognized me and then said, oh, that's Dean Crawley. Let him in the building. You know, so what did I do the next day? I had to file harassment charges against this police officer. An investigation was launched. And, you know, I could have walked away angry. I could have, you know, reacted out of fear, and I could have got shot. But the reality is that I, as a grown man, had to step back and say, this is a learning opportunity. I have to, you know, control my anger and say that, A, for the police department in general, they need to understand that there is an officer on this force who acts inappropriately towards African Americans, because even if I was a football player, you don't treat anybody the way that he treated me that day. And so it was a learning opportunity, but because I was a mature adult, I had to be able to say, I'm not going to deal with the anger that I feel right now. and use this as a learning opportunity. And that's the sad part about it, is that we've been victimized for so long in American society that it's hard for us to say, I'm going to use this as a learning opportunity and help educate, you know, a racist person or, you know, a person who has violated my rights. You know, that's the hard part. So what's the answer? The answer is that we got to continue to try to educate. You know, we do it on university campuses. We do it in high schools and junior highs and elementary schools. And there's always going to be extreme pockets of enlightenment and extreme pockets of ignorance. And we have to continue to fight.
Dr. Cunningham, your views on what we can do to deal with the root issue.
I think this is a case where you have to deal with the law itself, right? And so we need really beyond just, and I'm not, in addition to, well, I won't even say beyond, in addition to what Dr. Crawley has suggested, what we really need in this case is a equal applicability of the law. So, for example, in terms of this stand your ground law, I read a story earlier today it says a lot that this comes from a foreign newspaper, but I read from a London newspaper that white people who kill black people with stand your ground laws in states with stand your ground are 354% more likely, 354% more likely to be cleared of murder. Rather than the converse, right, when an African-American kills another African-American with stand your ground as the premise, or a black person kills a white person under that. And so beyond just even looking at the Trayvon Martin case, which arguably, I mean, many people have pointed out, well, listen, what I have to say suggests that Trayvon Martin was executing his own stand your ground. I mean, the other big case in Florida right now is the case of a black woman, right, Marissa Alexander, who is undergoing a current, you know, who just got sentenced to 20 years in prison under the same premise, right? She's attempted to stand her ground against her husband, who had been, you know, threatening her and who, you know, was, I guess, abusing her. She shoots him through the ceiling of her, she doesn't even shoot him. Used him through the ceiling of her apartment, and now subsequently she's doing 20 years in prison. So just to go along with what Dr. Crawley said, education, just applying the law as it's written, if you're going to keep it on the books the same, I think would go a long way as well.
Okay, we're going to take one of our callers. Vic, can you send them through?
He's there. Lamar, you're on the show with Sylvia and the panel. Go ahead and state your comment.
Yeah, I've been listening for a minute. Dr. Crawley and Dr. Phil, they both have valid points. Looking at some of this case, it is about, some of it's about race, some of it's about, because one, if you really think about it, a lot of racism is not blatant. It's so subtle that oftentimes white people don't see it as racism, or black people can't see the racism. Only way you're going to be able to solve this problem is, one, we have to change the laws that's on the book. There's a lot of old laws that are out there that need to be updated for current situations. We always talk about education. You know, education is the key. But we only can be educated if society wants us to be educated, which I don't think that's fully the case, because if that was the case, there would be more education about a lot of things in our school system at a very early age. The whole stand your ground thing is just a license to heal, in my opinion. It really, really needs to be looked at, like Dr. Phillip was saying. You know, there's another case that's coming up with this Davis kid where a white guy shoots a 17-year-old kid at a gas station. That trial's about to go on, too, and he's invoking the stand your ground situation. So but we all have to be mindful. And for me, I'm a black man, and I've been profiled myself. A lot of people don't know that when I was in college, I got pulled over. Me and one of my friends got pulled over one afternoon, and I was driving
police cars, and a lady popped one of my driver's license and registration. And I was like, what did I do? They're real angry at me, and I just didn't understand why I was surrounded by all these police cars. And another cop came to us and said, I fit the description of somebody who raped somebody that day. Now, the description was a black man with a baseball cap on, and everybody that knows me, I always wear a baseball cap. You know, so another instance, I got pulled over jail because they thought I was selling drugs because I had food stamps and I was in college. So there is some underlying that other people don't see that as a black man we always see, you know. So
I think we have some problems in the background. I'm sorry to cut you off, but there's a lot of noise going on in the background. I'm gonna bring Sylvia back in. Go ahead and finish your point, Dr. Cunningham.
To sort of respond to that, because the caller was making a point. What I'll just say to that is, you know, the caller said a lot about being profiled, and I think this is where we don't want to believe, for example, that race was a factor, but it's almost undeniable, primarily because, you know, if he was dressed in any other case, you know, in any other garb, if his skin was any other color, you know, I'm not quite sure Zimmerman would have ever followed him. And we know this, and we see the hypocrisy of this, you know, even in media today. So, for example, the great irony in this is Geraldo Rivera today has doubled down on his original claims about if Trayvon wasn't dressed like a thug, and thug is, of course, a very loaded term, he would have never been followed, right? And the irony of this is that, of course, it's Geraldo Rivera, and he has about as much credibility as a ground slug. But the other thing that's sort of, sort of interesting about his comments, too, is that you've seen Geraldo in, you know, hoodies all across the Internet, right? As soon as he said it the first time, he saw billions and billions of pictures of hoodies. And so the clothing that a young African male wears becomes marked as soon as he puts it on his body. And that's what George Zimmerman did. He marked it because of what he wore and who he was.
I'm sorry. Is everybody good on the line, because I'm having a little problem hearing everything.
I'm good. It's just me here, so I'm fine.
Here. Okay, because I heard a lot of static, and I was trying to figure out whose line it is and stuff like that. I'm going to bring Sylvia back on in a second, but we've got a caller, Pete, that's on the line, and Pete wanted to give his thoughts on the whole situation. Pete.
Okay.
Welcome to Time Out, and go ahead and say what you got.
Hello, can anyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, just have a couple of points to make. One, to the young lady who earlier stated that Mr. Zimmerman was just doing his job, I'd like to ask the question, exactly what job was that? George Zimmerman was self-appointed neighborhood watch. That means basically the gated community that he lived in did not actually have a neighborhood self-watch group that was actually organized. He decided to go ahead and do this on his own volition. Also, if he had actually paid attention to neighborhood watch protocol, he would have known not to have a weapon with him. So to go ahead and say that he was doing his job, I would argue, and actually probably argue correctly, that no, you're wrong, he was not doing his job. He was out there basically with a very crazy mindset that he wanted to be some system justice type persona, okay? Number two, I've heard people, we talk about what can we do in terms of basically addressing this issue. We talk about education and all this. No, I think it comes down to something a little bit more simple right now, something very much that's just not being talked about. This comes down to accountability, okay? This comes down to basically those supporters right now looking at what has happened here for what it is. Every time something like this comes up, folks want to go ahead and start bringing other aspects into it. You want to start talking about black-on-black crime. You want to talk about the number of kids that are killed in Chicago every day. You want to talk about, you know, world hunger issues all the way out in Burma. That is not the point. We're looking at the situation that has happened right here. Look at it for what it is. Deal with it for what it is. You have an adult man who basically shot and killed a young boy who was basically, whose only crime was basically going to the store and getting a snack. But now you want to go ahead and you want to impugn that young man's reputation. You want to talk about things that have absolutely nothing to do with the case. You want to talk about his problems in school. Okay, great. He had issues in school. What exactly does all of that have to do with what happened that night? It has nothing to do with it. So, again, the problem really comes down to there's a segment of society that truly needs to basically wake up, look at this for what it is, and just basically ask yourself the question, honestly, are you looking at this because you're just, you don't want to see, you don't want to face what the reality is, that there is a problem in this country with how people are being viewed, or are you just basically that blind? That's all I have to say on the issue.
Could I answer that?
Go ahead, Angel. Go ahead, Angel.
Okay. He asked me, you know, because I said he was doing his job, did George Zimmerman just wake up one day and go, you know what, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to patrol my neighborhood because kids have been vandalizing it and carrying on and whatever. Did he just start the night that Trayvon died, or had he been doing it for a while? And I think he's been doing it for a while because they spoke to some people in the neighborhood and said, yeah, I see him out here. He patrols the neighborhood. He's good, you know, what have you. So the neighborhood people, they knew he'd been doing it. If they had a problem with it, they would have said something. If the police really had an issue with it, with him carrying, they would have said something. They had an issue that night, and he's called in before, so they knew him. They knew who he was. It's not like he woke up one day and said, yeah, there's a kid out here, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to patrol the area. He's been doing this for a while. Okay, he's self-appointed, but people know who he is. They don't have, that's what Neighborhood Watch is for. For people who, because cops can't go everywhere, cops can't be everywhere at the same time. Hell, we have it in my one-mile-wide town. We have someone that patrols the neighborhood. And we know he's there, and we know what he does. That's his job, a volunteer.
I will grant you what a Neighborhood Watch is, but I will also grant you this because I have actually been on part of a Citizens Police Academy and actually went through Neighborhood Watch Patrol training. I will definitely tell you this right now. To answer your first question, did he just wake up one day and decide to do this? The answer is yes, he did. Because, again, he did not go through his gated community protocol. He did not actually, yes, they accepted the fact that he was doing it. But, yeah, he just one day decided upon himself to do this. Number two, again, if you go through any type of Citizens Police Academy and you go through Neighborhood Watch training, you understand that the intent is basically observe and report. It never states that anywhere in this protocol, observe, report, carry a weapon, and go ahead and play police. It never stated that. Why did people not have an issue with it prior to? Well, because he hadn't shot anyone prior to that. Ask the question now, are they going to have an issue with it at this particular point? I'm thinking they're probably going to have a few issues with it because he went a little above and beyond what he needed to do. He should not have been out there with a loaded weapon trying to call himself a protector. He should have listened to the dispatcher when they told him, do not engage. He decided upon himself to go ahead and engage them. Exactly where in any Citizens Police Academy or any Neighborhood Watch protocol will you find, and it has been stated by the national director that that is not part of it, but please tell me, where does it state anywhere in the rules that you are supposed to engage someone? Observe and report. Not observe, report, and engage. Can you please answer that question for me?
Okay. I agree with you with that instance. He should have kept his butt right there when they said, do not engage him. He should not have engaged him. But on the same...
Should he have had a gun with him? Should he have had a weapon with him?
Honestly,
based on everything you know about Citizens Police and Neighborhood Watch, and by protocol, which specifically states you are not to have a weapon, should he have had a weapon with him?
Okay, let me tell you something here. And I'm only speaking for Lamont, Missouri. Our neighborhood patrol guy, he has a gun.
He's also very wrong for that, too. By law, this protocol, he's very wrong for that.
Got it. Pete and Angela. I mean, Angel, I keep calling you Angela. First time I called you before. I got to stop you both real quick, okay? We got to take a step back because we don't want, you know, an attack on attack, you know, type deal. We're going to discuss the matter at hand. I'm going to try to bring Sylvia back in so she can move the topic along because we have a panel here. We want to get everybody in. So what I want to do is try to bring her on, and I think she wants to talk about the civil lawsuit that everyone's talking about. Sylvia, can you hear me? Sylvia, you there? Oh, wow. Okay.
Please understand, I'm not, again, to the young lady, I'm not trying to attack you. I'm just trying to think that's an aspect of the conversation that truly, really got lost in the whole scenario from the very beginning. I understand what you're saying with the guy in your patrol that does it, but again, legally, it's wrong for a neighborhood watch person to carry a weapon. That's by neighborhood watch bylaws nationwide. So again, if I come across as I'm attacking you, that is not my intent, and my apologies to that. But again, that's
no,
where this thing
I didn't take
should not have done that.
And I didn't take it as that. Like I said, all I can say is what our neighborhood watch guy does, and he has a gun, and I didn't take it as you attacking me, not at all. I just, you know, and I can't speak for the neighborhood watches all over the United States. I spoke for the one that I knew here in 1 mile wide town of Lamont, Missouri, and he has a gun.
All right. Okay, we're going to move along. I love the spirited debate. We'll try to get Sylvia back on because normally I'm in the background being quiet, but she's having some technical difficulties. Again, we have Dr. Rex Crawley, Dr. Philip Cunningham, the self-proclaimed housewife extraordinaire diva, Angel Arnold, on the line.
Yes.
On this panel. And we're discussing, ladies and gentlemen, we're discussing the George Zimmerman trial verdict. But the more important thing is the undertones of the trial and what it means for our country. There's a soundbite I'm going to play here in Sylvia's absence. It's along the lines of, should this go toward a civil prosecution? Let me play the soundbite and try to get Sylvia back.
There's no decision yet, but the Obama administration has been conducting its own investigation. The Justice Department has not yet disclosed whether it is preparing its own charges against George Zimmerman for violating Trayvon Martin's civil rights with racial profiling.
Yeah.
President Obama writes the best way to honor Trayvon is for communities to improve their own understanding and cooperation.
All right. I believe Sylvia is back, and we
back.
Can get her back on here. All right, there you go. There you go. Sorry.
Okay.
I let you still run amok. Run, you got bamboo. Go ahead.
I could hear everything, but I couldn't say anything. A lot of people had a problem with President Obama's statement. He said something to the effect of, if he were to ever have a son, that he would look very much like Trayvon. And, he gave his opinion, but just tried to stay away from whether he thought, Zimmerman was guilty or not. He just, stated that his heart went out to the family, and if he had a son, his son would be African-American too. And there were a lot of got an uproar about it. I personally didn't think there was anything wrong with the statement, but people were upset because they felt like if the President of the United States comes on TV and gives his views, then Zimmerman did not have a fair trial. Dr. Crawley, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, the interesting thing is Obama did say that, and folks did complain, and George Zimmerman was found not guilty. So what does that say about even, the highest office in the land? Who happens to be a black man. So there was a concern that, the president could taint this trial. But, even if that was a potential and that argument was valid, it did not. So it just showed us the power of sort of this deep-seated racism that exists in America. I can't I can't separate or I can't get past the whole prosecution of this case. You know, as if the Zimmerman, Martin family had the opportunity to choose their own attorney, I think that the case would have been just a lot different. You know, but by virtue of the fact that they had no control over the case, they weren't able to pour resources into finding him guilty like Zimmerman was able to pour resources into proving him innocent. And so a jury, that was not a jury of his peers. You know, so, you know, when we heard about the jury selection and the demographics of the jury, you know, red flags went up immediately. But we said, clearly, this is an open and shut case. There's no way a jury of women and mothers could not sympathize with Trayvon Martin's situation. And here we found, in this, even in this situation, that he was found guilty. And so, you know, civil case, I think they have a much better chance in the civil case because they will pull out their guns now. It's the family's time to garner resources and say, we're going to find the best attorney that's going to put together a case that is reflective of what happened that night and not have to rely on the prosecuting attorney's team, who I just think did a horrible job.
You bring up an interesting point, Dr. Crowley, about the jury. Dr. Cunningham, can you put your thoughts on the jury that was selected and how you felt about the jury that served on this case?
Well, I'll just first say I agree wholeheartedly with Dr. Crowley in regards to it clearly wasn't a jury of his peers, of Zimmerman's peers. And, you know, in many regards, you know, you have to think about what a jury is charged with, and you know, in many regards, they're charged with basically determining not truth, right? They're charged with determining validity, strength of argument. And so, what I think a lot of us did was assume, as Dr. Crowley suggested, that perhaps they would be more inclined to side with Trayvon's parents, because they themselves were parents. One of the jurors was a person of color herself, and I know one of the articles I read about this, there was some suggestion that during the trial she cried. And we assumed, maybe erroneously, that maybe she was crying because, you know, of the tragic death. And the gruesome details involved, but we have no idea why she was crying. And furthermore, we have no idea who she was sympathetic with and the like. So having lived in Florida and having experienced the jury selection process there myself, just trying to be on it when I was called for jury duty, I'm sure it's no different than the other state, right? But you, in many regards, you're trying to find the least informed, and in terms of, you know, the actual events itself, you're trying to find the least informed about that event, right? Because you as a prosecutor, you as a defender, want to be able to mold their minds, right, to your cause. And I think at the end of the day, again, just to reiterate what Dr. Crowley suggested, it was just a failure by the prosecution to really mold them towards, you know, the argument he was trying to create. And in part, it's because he really didn't have a clear-cut narrative.
Angel, do you have any comments about the jury?
To be honest, when they had the jury selection, I saw who was on the jury. I said, okay, this is going to go in favor of Trayvon's parents because they're all women, they're mothers, they're grandmothers. So I thought, I was surprised that there was not a man on the jury. The jury, when she showed emotion, you know, the woman was talking about, the juror was crying, like the panelist said, well, you know, we don't know what she was crying about. She could have been crying because of the tragicness of the crime, which I would have been crying. She could have been crying because, you know, her heart went out to Trayvon's mother. I cried because I have a teenage son. My heart went out to his mother. No one should have to bury their child. Hopefully,
the next jury, if they do have another trial, it will be interesting to see who is on that jury.
I agree. I think this sheds some light on some things, and I think they will try to have more representation, at least a man on jury duty, as well as even an African-American on duty. So I want to move to a different topic because I think I was talking to our producer a little bit earlier today, and I think we have to change somehow the perception of African-American men. And this is easier said than done, obviously. This has been happening for years, so it takes time to undo what's already in the minds of people and in their mindsets. But I think that, you know, we have to find a way to do away with the stereotypes and not just book by its cover. Understand that there are some people on Wall Street with dreadlocks, and there are African-Americans who own NASCAR companies, and there are, you know, we just got to blur those lines and not judge it by the cover. You know, there are people with tattoos, and people automatically make an assumption on based on the tattoo that's on their neck, you know, and so somehow we've got to do away with this stereotype that if someone's on their head, then they must be a thug. And so, Dr. Crowley, what are your thoughts? Like, how do we even tackle that? How do we change that mindset? Because it's an issue.
So here in Pittsburgh, for example, and I won't even say Pittsburgh, but nationwide, there is concern about exactly this. Open Society Foundation, for example, has dedicated close to $200 million to helping to reverse the negative images associated with African-American men. Here in Pittsburgh, the Heinz Endowments, for example, has dedicated their entire grant funding operation to African-American men and boys. And so the first project for us was to do a media scan over the last 10 years to look at the depiction of African-American men in newspapers, on TV, on radio, and it was appalling. It was so appalling that the foundation said, you know what, all of our resources are going to this issue. And so here in Pittsburgh, we are aggressively and insanely focused on African-American male development. I had a research center that was funded by the Heinz Endowment, which is a predominantly white institution, who gave me $1.8 million to say, you better help us balance out the depictions and images of black men in media and research, in publications, everywhere. And so there is a movement. There's an interesting, quiet storm that's happening that folks are beginning to be engaged and concerned about the plight of African-American men in America. And so those are some of the things. And we can't do it all on our own. This is the first time I've been able to engage in programming where funding was not an issue because organizations in the community are saying, we've got to contribute to this, and we as Caucasian Americans understand that we can't do it. So the only thing we can do is help the people who are like-minded, who are assertive and aggressive about changing these images, and fund programs that are proven effective. And so I think that's the only way that it's going to happen, is that folks really recognize this as a crisis, an alarm at the gate. You know, African-American males are facing extinction. And small incidents like this happen every day in communities across America. Unfortunately, Trayvon's death is not unique. Here in Pittsburgh, just yesterday, an African-American male was murdered. You know, and so it happens so regularly that we become almost immune to it. And until we sound that alarm by being as vocal and as aggressive as we can, things are just not going to change.
Dr. Cunningham, your thoughts on how we change those stereotypes?
Well, like Dr. Crawley, I mean, we're both media study scholars, and so I'm sort of also inclined to believe that part of it is, making sure that the mediated images of African-American men represent the balance. I'm not someone who says that things have to be rosy color, right? That every time you show an African-American man on television, it needs to be through rose-colored lenses, right? There is a spectrum of blackness, for lack of a better term. And as someone who, for example, writes about hip-hop, loves hip-hop, and, you know, was born of the hip-hop generation, for example, I'm willing to sort of accept that there are various iterations of blackness that are out there, some of which I don't like, some of which I don't understand, but they have that right to exist. On the converse, though, I think one of the main issues is, and at the heart of what Dr. Crawley was suggesting, is that there's just not enough balance. And so, for example, just anecdotally speaking, right now we've at the heart of, we're seeing all these peaceful protests, occur throughout the nation, and they're getting some media coverage, right? But they're not getting a whole lot of media coverage, in part because nothing's happening, right? But you can believe, because prior to this event, right, we were at this moment where we were wondering, well, are black people going to riot, right? And then the riots didn't happen. And so there's nowhere to point the cameras. There's nothing to sort of watch. Watching a peaceful protest is not good television. And so until those images are balanced, until we see some sort of variations, I'm inclined to agree with Dr. Crawley. It's just not going to change, particularly because media is so dominant. It is such a tremendous factor in our individual lives.
I think one of the things that I was thinking about as I was watching the trial, and my producer and I talked about this as well, is there seems to be a lack of a village. They say it takes a village to raise a child, and I think Dr. Cunningham, you're saying that media plays a role in this, and they're not really covering the protests, and that's something that people are trying to do to take a stand. But unless it's violent or something that they consider newsworthy, then it's getting very little media play. I think we can't control the media. I think it's going to take a while to change race relations just because it's been present for so long in our country. I think it's going to take time. I think it's going to take people open dialogues between all races. But in the meantime, I think that we as a community have to do a better job of educating our youth. And a lot of that happens through a village. And the village no longer exists the way it did years ago. There seems to be a sense of people feeling like they don't want to get involved. So they kind of turn a blind eye. Whereas growing up, people watched to see what was going on. If they saw me doing something wrong, or if they saw me doing something dangerous, that would get me shot, then I said, hey, you can't do that. You just can't do that. You'll get yourself hurt. And then they called my parents, and my parents would, if there weren't any parents, then you got that from the community, and everybody kind of helped each other. And there seems to be a lack of that. I think we need more of that, more of people pulling together so that we can educate our young people on, like what Dr. Crowley said, how to handle anger. And how to say, listen, I'm not going to let this person upset me right now. I'm going to use this as an educational opportunity, but that has to be taught. Kids just don't naturally have that. They just react. If they're angry, they react. And so, Dr. Cunningham, what are your thoughts about just the village? There seems to be a lack of presence in terms of a village for our young people.
Well, a couple of things. I think, one, it's really important at this moment to sort of realize that, it's not so much that there's an absence, right? I mean, for example, we all know, Dr. Crawley himself, runs a black male initiative to, educate and, enlighten people. I work with other people like Sean Patterson, who we both know, who runs his own foundation. We know people who are hands-on in their communities and are doing the hard work to get there, right? They don't seek the publicity. They certainly don't get it. So I think we have to, one, be careful in not overlooking people in their individual efforts to get to the community and do well. I think, though, in fairness to your point, though, we are at a moment where the community, as we have grown up in it, right? I mean, we are three individuals here in particular, with exception who grew up together, right? And as someone, I mean, and I'll just use myself as an example, right? As someone who grew up fatherless and grew up poor, you know, I know the difficulties of, you know, sort of going out there. And, you know, all the programs you enroll people in for all the education you give them, sometimes, I mean, the reality is, unfortunately, that doesn't change their material conditions, right? And there is a, and so, you know, with that, you know, sometimes there's increasing pressure even when you're getting good messages, even when somebody is watching you, even when you have people giving you good advice, as I did. You know, I had Dr. Crawley. I had your father. I had, you know, a bunch of people, my uncles, you know, who were able to do that. But at the end of the day, you know, sometimes those words and those deeds of an active community, sometimes they fall short. And it's not necessarily anybody's fault. So if anything, it's just, I think we need to just continue those efforts and hopefully, you know, they reap some results. But I think it's important to note that they are out there, they are occurring.
Yeah, I do want to make clear that I was not excluding the people who are out there and trying to create that village. We covered that on a couple of shows before. Once, Angel, we covered that on a couple of shows before, that there are some African-American fathers, parents who are out there raising their kids. And so some people, I don't want to, I don't want to say that there aren't any, but there seems to be less of that. What was my point? Angel, you wanted to say something? Go ahead.
I think also, I mean, I agree with the whole village thing. I grew up, my mom was a single mother in the military, worked 40 plus hours a week. But if I did something wrong and one of the neighbors or whoever saw me doing something wrong, they told her and assured that if my mom's thing was, if someone has to tell me something that you're doing that you know you should not be doing, when I get home from work, I can't say it, your butt is mine, so to speak. And I believe that, and I teach my children that it has to start, you know, the village, yes, is dying. It has to start at home with the parents. If there is someone out there, the kids can go to the Girls and Boys Club, and there's a positive person there telling them, okay, this is what you need to do. This is what you don't do if someone approaches you. But then when they go home and their mom is telling them, well, if someone does this or says this to you, you don't have to take that. You just tell them, and then if they're not positive at home, if they don't have, like, a positive start at home, and I could be wrong, then that village is not going to do any good. It has to start with their home life, with someone telling them, just because someone tells you to pull up your pants, you say yes, sir, no, ma'am. You say okay, you pull up your pants and you keep on going. Do not get an attitude. If they, you know, just because of the way you're dressed, if they say something to you, ignore it. Don't get all puffed up and try to show how big and bad you are. Those are just words, and you keep on going. And I just think it starts at home, and mine can tell you, if they know that if they act up in school or if anything and I'm told about it, that's it.
Okay. Dr. Crawley, Angel is just explaining that she doesn't think the concept of a village, you know, when you say it takes a village to raise a child, she doesn't think that the village will work if there aren't, things aren't enforced at home with the parents. And for many children across our country, there isn't a good home setting, or there may not even be parents, or one of the parents may not be there. What are your thoughts on a village and educating and surrounding, wrapping our arms around our youth and educating them about how to deal with anger and how to use things as a learning tool? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I can tell you that a research project that we're engaged now really centers around this whole notion of wraparound services. So we're interested in academic success. And as a professor, you know, I'm biased in believing that the more a person is educated, the more sound decisions they'll be able to make and the more productive they'll be in American society. So I'm on the education side. And I recognize college is not for everybody. So I'm really talking about those parents who believe that their children can and should go to college. That's the case group that I'm focused on in my world. And so what we realize is that this whole notion of village has changed dramatically, because in my village were people that cared about me. So what do you do when Zimmerman is in the village, when the fox has gotten into the hen house? And so we're telling our children that, you know, trust people around you, and if somebody tells you not to do something, but what about when somebody, you know, jumped out of a car and got a gun? You know, and so village for us was this sort of urban community where everybody went to church on a Sunday, and everybody knew their neighbor's name, and I could go to Miss Ida's house and have some spaghetti, and, you know, Carol had some Fruit Loops for me. But that's just not the reality now. I live in the suburbs now. You know, I am careful and cautious about my kids interacting in the village. And so village being reified and redefined in ways that we really got to stop and wonder whether or not even that analogy is appropriate. And so when we look at this whole notion of wraparound services for our kids, we recognize that, yeah, generally the village concept works, but it's different than the village that we grew up in. And so how do you respond to that? How do you deal with the high school kids who I dealt with this summer who came to me and I asked them, you know, how many folks have ever seen a dead body, for example, and four or five kids start telling a story about when somebody got murdered in their neighborhood and one of their friends was playing in the blood that was in the street. You know, and here I am, a 50-year-old man, and never seen a dead body. How do I help them through that? You know, and so the whole notion of wraparound services says that we got kids who are dealing with psychological issues. You know, the reason they're not reading is not because they're dumb, but because oftentimes they are traumatized. And so where are the psychological services associated with trying to help maintain us for these black guys? You know, so the village looks a lot different. You know, the villagers have to be trained professionals that understand the lived experiences of particularly African-American men, if that's who we're trying to save. You there?
Sylvia? Okay, we lost Sylvia. I guess I got to take control again, guys. Go ahead, Angel. Go ahead.
I
think media plays a great part in it as well, because a lot of our young people, they can turn on the TV at any day and see, you know, basketball players, you know, rappers, you name it, wearing the and it's I don't mean the stereotype, but it's only true, wearing the baggy pants and having the attitude that, you know, I don't care what anyone says, I'm going to do my own thing, I'm the boss. They have no respect for, you know, like the villagers, the old-time villagers. They have no respect for someone coming out saying, you know, excuse me, you need to pull up your pants. The first thing they want to do is get an attitude. The young men that come to my house, no, you don't step in Miss Angel's house with baggy pants. You take off your hat. There is no bad language in my house. But you know, I can turn on the TV at any moment, and my son can sit there and he's watching these videos. He's watching role models that, you know, they act like they're on the streets or whatever, and it's who our kids are looking at. And I'm trying to articulate it,
I follow you, and I'm going to do this because I know we have Sylvia's back, and I know somebody else wants to say something, but I just want to chime in on that. There's something called parental lock that I use on my DirecTV, and I block everything. If my kids want to watch something, if they want to watch something, they're going to ask me for the code, because I change it, because my sons are sneaky. They like to look at every little thing I put in. They try to use the birth dates and everything. But, Angel, I love you, and you know I do, because you know, you were with me in Germany, and you were one of my biggest support, or the biggest supporter. You made that known. And your children love you, too. They love you, too. And the thing is, the way you and Chad raise them, and by the way, I hope you don't mind me doing this, Angel. Angel's African-American female. Her husband is a Latino male. So she has biracial children, right? So when she's talking about Dakota, who's her son, you know, how does he feel about this? You know, George Zimmerman is half Jewish, half Portuguese, but he identifies with the Caucasian race. He circles in, or he did on the forms that I saw, circled in white as his ethnicity. So how does a parent, you know, of a biracial family, you know, say, okay, well, you know what? Are you going to identify with this culture? You going to identify with that culture? I'd be damned if any of my children look at the little Wayne. Period. That dude like a gremlin. He looked like the head gremlin. And the lyrics? I mean, that's why, I don't know about anybody else on the line, but I play, you know, the old school. My kids love them some Teddy P and all that stuff because that's what my mother raised me on. It was suggestive, but not as suggestive as today's music. And again, right. It takes that village and that parent and that group of people to surround your children so that they don't use Lil Wayne as a role model. Because if they do, they're doomed. Our society is doomed if Lil Wayne is your role model. I would even venture to say Jay-Z would be somewhat doomed. Because even though he's a mogul in music and business, the way he came up was terrible. It was terrible. You can say, well.
Okay, I'm back. Vic, can you hear me?
I'm sorry. I was going off. I know.
Because I know you can just go on and on. You have strong opinions about this. Real, before we're going to start to wrap up the show, Dr. Cunningham, as we end the show, what are your thoughts on what we can do moving forward to improve race relations in America? Dr. Cunningham.
I think one of the things we have to always be cautious of when moments like this happens is, you know, and I'll speak from my own experience. When things like this happen, I have to always remember the good in all of this, right? And in that, you know, when things like this happen, the people who get upset about it, the people who are troubled about this, the people who actually go up and stand up and fight about this are multi-hue, right? Racism is fighting a very strong battle. You know, but maybe I hope it's losing the war. And I can say, you know, just from my own experiences, you know, I am quite fortunate in that I have a number of friends who, you know, are of various ethnicities, various races, many of whom, particularly, and I'll speak, you know, candidly about, you know, some of them who are white, who are aware of the privilege that affords them, and they are aware of it. They're conscious of it, and some of them fight like hell to remove that. And so I think we just have to, you know, always remember that, you know, there are people out there of multiple ethnicities who, I'm not going to give the platitude that they're good people, but that our relationships between with each other don't have to be determined by the latest media, you know, sensation, the latest scandal, the latest controversy, right? It should be determined by those people who are real for us, and, you know, we just continue to do the work to make sure that, you know, people are educated, people learn, and that we are all interacting on as equal a basis as humanly possible.
Dr. Crowley, your thoughts on how we move forward in terms of beginning the process to change race relations in America?
Well, I know one of the things that I would like to see happen immediately is our attitude towards guns. I know that when I look at the Black Lives, and in our local paper, we have a running column every, and it's an African American paper, and it comes out once a week. And in that running column, it identifies every young Black male life that's been killed throughout the year. And we're headed for a record year. And all of those Black lives are, you know, because of gun violence. And so to some degree, we've got to, you know, we got to take a stronger stance on this whole notion of when I was a kid, if I got mad at somebody, you know, it was a fight. You know, we was down in Garfield Playground and, you know, we fighting. You know, nowadays you got, you know, 10 to 11, 8, 9 graders who are pulling guns on kids and shooting people. You know, so take away guns and you deal with conflict management in very different ways. So I think that's one of the practical, you know, policy issues that we're facing now is this whole notion of guns in our communities, and we've got to deal with that or we're going to continue to see black men die regularly.
Angel, can you give us your thoughts on how we move forward towards changing race relations in America?
I think one thing we can do in our communities, from the richest of communities to the poorest of communities, we need, as a nation, we need to have, I guess, forums, so to speak, in like our cities, from, you know, the higher, like the mayor and, you know, up that high down to just your average Joe, you know, working maybe no job. We need to get together with people in the community, and we need to hash out, okay, what seems to be the issue here? What makes you look at me and think, okay, this is, he's going to do something, he's wrong, or she's bad, or he's bad? And they need to come to an understanding. Unless you sit down and talk about it, because I could see you on the street and you have baggy pants, you have whatever, and if your whole demeanor is, I guess, off to me, I'm going to think that something's wrong. We need to come together, and unless you tell me this is how I am or I'm not like this, I'm not going to know. We need to talk to one another. That's my thing. I think we need to come together as a nation in our cities, start there, and we need to talk. We need to have forums. We need to go, okay, what is the problem here?
I agree. We need panels. We need forums. And we need different races represented on those panels so that we can start the dialogue and have some conversation. I want to close the show out with this. My great-grandmother once said that if there's something that bothers you about the world, you have two choices. You can complain about it, or you can change it. And so I want to encourage everyone who is listening on this call and or participating on this call to do what you can to change it. We have a couple of professors on this line. If you have the ability to create forums and panel discussions, by all means, I want to encourage you to do that, to start to change how we think about race in our country. And so do your part in changing what's going on. And that might be as simple as do your role to break down the stereotypes. You know, if you're a black man, then you do your role in changing how they perceive black men. And so that to the point where if Angel is walking down the street, if she had an encounter with you, Dr. Cunningham, and your pants were sagged down, and I know you got to get your pants tapered at the bottom, but if your pants if your pants were sagging down and Angel met you, get her to understand that you're a good person, and just because your pants are sagging doesn't rob her or mug her. When you do that, you have broken a stereotype in her mind, at least, that every black man is not that way. That's one small thing that you can do, and if everyone does part to change race relations, and it's going to take time. It's going to take years, because there's years of things that have happened. There's the Rodney King trial. There's the O.J. Simpson trial. Now there's this trial, and many more before these. But if we all do our small part in doing what we can to break down stereotypes and create panels and forum discussions, because we can't afford to wait on the media, you know, and we can't afford to wait on the judicial system to change and the gun laws to change, hopefully this sheds light on those situations and those things do change. But until then, what we can do is do our part. You can complain or you can change it. I'm Sylvia Crawley. This is my time. You've been listening to Time Out. Take us home.
Tell me what you want. Tell me what you see. Where you want to go. What you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take
wanna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you looking right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweats, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.